home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Live from Hollywood, it's Rated LGBT Radio with your hosts, Garrett Miller and Rob Watson.
Welcome, welcome, and good evening. You are listening to Rated LGBT Radio. I am Rob Watson, your host, and I thank Garrett Miller as our executive producer. We have an incredible show tonight. We had a huge tragedy, as you are probably aware, this last week in Las Vegas, where the worst gun violence in American history took place. This is becoming a habitual thing for America. We're just a little over a year away from the Pulse shooting, and before that, Sandy Hook, where young children lost their lives. Many of us are feeling like that if we didn't get the wake-up call when we lost so many children, when will we ever? And that seems to be progressing. It's sort of like a parallel to climate change and hurricanes. If we don't do something about climate change, hurricanes drowning our states will be the new normal. If we don't do something about gun violence, then these kind of shootings will be the new normal. Many of us do not want to sit still for that. Many of us do not want to have that be normal. We want it to go to something that we solve, something we overcome. And we're hoping that maybe even the LGBT community can stand forward, jump up, and be the forefront of this. Tonight's show, we have, and I'm very honored that he's joining us, Congressman David Cicilline is coming on board. This is one of our lawmakers who is not sitting by and waiting for something else to happen. He is the first one to jump on legislation to help ease some of the issue with gun violence. He also coincidentally is co-chair of the Congressional LGBT Equality Caucus and vice chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. He will be joining us in just a few seconds. Also, Aaron Overman of Gays Without Guns will be joining us after that. First, I want to welcome on board my panel, Brody Levesque and Karen Olcom,
good evening, Rob.
Distinguished journalists. Welcome, folks. And with
Hi.
That, I would like to welcome aboard the Honorable Congressman Cicilline. Welcome, Congressman.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for being you. Thank you for doing what you're doing. Can you tell us about the bill that you have just introduced to Congress?
Yes. There are a number of bills that have been introduced in the Congress. I've been working on the issue of reducing gun violence in this country since I was in the Rhode Island State Legislature, and I was a founding member of Mayors Against Illegal Guns with Mayor Menino and Mayor Bloomberg when I was mayor of Providence, and now serving my fourth term in Congress, and have made advocating for responsible gun safety legislation part of my portfolio of priorities. And, after the Las Vegas shooting, when we saw the use of that shooter, not only obviously the loss of 59 individuals and more than 500 people injured, but the use of the bump stocks. This is a device that allows someone to essentially take a semi-automatic weapon, which is already a very deadly weapon that can shoot on average between 70 and 100 rounds per minute. It takes a semi-automatic weapon and essentially gives it the functionality of a machine gun, and then increases its ability to shoot by about 400 to 800 bullets a minute. So it really makes a semi-automatic weapon a machine gun. A machine gun is already, a fully automatic weapon is already illegal in most jurisdictions with some limited exceptions. So my legislation prohibits the manufacture, sale, or possession of these bump stocks, which are devices that can rapidly accelerate the discharge of the bullets from a semi-automatic weapon and give it the kind of functionality of a fully automatic machine gun type weapon. And so, back in 2010, the tobacco ATF ruled that these bump stocks were permissible under the existing statute, so that they weren't unlawful. So Congress, I think, has to take action immediately. I introduced this bill called the Automatic Gunfire Prevention Act, and we now have over 160 co-sponsors in the Congress in just 2 days, which is a great beginning. Those are all Democrats, but I'm in active conversations with six or seven Republican colleagues trying to get some Republicans on board so that the bill will be bipartisan.
Yeah, this seems like such a foundational bill that should be a no-brainer. Brody, I think you have a question for the congressman.
Yeah, good evening, Congressman, and thank you again for joining us this evening.
My pleasure.
Sir, if you don't mind my asking, how do we look at House leadership, your piece of legislation, and a bipartisan effort to get this bill moved through to the floor and then over to the Senate and eventually conference?
Well, I mean, there's a Senate version. Senator Feinstein has introduced the identical bill that I introduced in the House. So there's a Senate companion. There are some Republicans that are talking about introducing their own bill, you know, which is fine. I mean, I'm not at all interested in whose bill it is so long as we finally ban these bump stocks. So it may be for political reasons that the Republicans are not going to want to join a Democratic bill and maybe will introduce their own bill. But I think, you know, there is definitely some interest from my Republican colleagues to get on board. I think everyone watched this incident with incredible horror. I mean, one of the challenges, to be perfectly honest, is, you know, we've been through this before. We have a terrible mass shooting, whether it's Orlando or Sandy Hook or San Bernardino. And, you know, everyone sort of does a moment of silence and extends their thoughts and prayers, and then Congress does absolutely nothing about it. And so I'm very frustrated because, you know, we have these 30-minute moments of silence and they sort of become perfunctory, and that's the sum total of what Congress does. And so I'm, you know, obviously aware of that history, and so I'm continuing to press with my colleagues that, you know, when it's the worst massacre, the, you know, worst mass shooting in American history with nearly 60 people murdered and more than 500 injured. I mean, if you know, you just have to wonder what's the number that will finally motivate my friends on the other side of the aisle to come forward and enact some responsible gun safety legislation. But, you know, we have to keep fighting for it because it's about life and death. It's about protecting the American people. And I think people are very frustrated because they think Congress is not responding to the best interests of the American people and instead to the very powerful special interests in the gun lobby. And we have to, you know, we have an opportunity here to prove that we can work together and get something done for the American people. And I'm really hopeful that this will be the occasion and that finally happens.
Sir, before I hand you over to my colleague, Karen Oakham of the Los Angeles Blade, I have a follow-up if you don't mind. Congressman, when you were just speaking about the gun lobby, let's talk about the NRA for just a minute, sir. As you know, the National Rifle Association had sent out a press release earlier today, but they were specific about the fact that they wanted this handled by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, which would make that an administrative action versus what you're proposing to do legislatively. Congressman, if you don't mind, my follow-up question would be then, sir, is it not disingenuous of the NRA to ask for an administrative solution to the problem versus a law solution to the problem?
Well, I mean, the NRA issued a statement today, you know, essentially calling on the agency to review and more heavily regulate bump stocks. I'm not exactly sure what that means, but certainly the Bureau has the ability to reverse the decision that was made in 2010 and say that under their reading of the statute, bump stocks are illegal. But, you know, that, you know, we don't know that they would actually come to that conclusion. And in addition to that, that could be reversed by the next agency head. So, I mean, I think that's fine, but I think the best way to permanently ban these bump stocks and to be sure that they no longer can be possessed or purchased or manufactured is for Congress to do its job. Obviously, I'm most interested in getting these bump stocks banned, and so if the agency were to do it quickly, that'd be great. I still think it would be wise for us to move forward with the legislation so that we can be sure that that administrative action can never be reversed.
Thank you, sir.
Karen, do you have a question for
back to Rob?
Karen, you have a question for the congressman?
I do, and thank you so much for spending a few minutes with us and explaining this to us. You're from Rhode Island, and we we all know very well about Family Week in Rhode Island. And, you know, scanning the photos from Las Vegas, I came across this wide shot of the field. And it was, you know, there was all this debris in the field. And then I looked closer and I could see bodies there. You know, nobody's talking about in the well of Congress. It doesn't seem that anybody is talking about the human beings whose lives were lost. You and Congressman Lewis and so many others so courageously took to the floor, the well of the House, and did a sit-in, you know, after the Pulse shooting. You know, with this information that the shooter scouted different locations, it strikes me that, you know, Family Week could have been one of his targets. I mean, just possibly. Can you respond, especially for LGBT people who might think that somehow other than Pulse, we really aren't, you know, gun violence doesn't really matter to us? I mean, can you speak to the human side of this?
Yeah, no, I think it's a really important point. You know, sadly, these mass shootings have become such a frequent occurrence that the danger is that people become numb to the human tragedy and the loss of life. I mean, think about, you know, the families of the 59 people who were killed in Las Vegas, whose lives are destroyed, who have lost a loved one, who will never celebrate a birthday with that individual or an anniversary or Christmas or whatever holiday. I mean, this is a, you know, gun violence and the loss of a family member to gun violence is just something that rips apart a family. When I was mayor, I had the responsibility of comforting parents and siblings who lost a loved one to gun violence in my city, and there's nothing more painful. And, you know, sometimes because these incidents happen with such frequency, it's sometimes you have to, you know, caution folks not to lose the enormity of the loss and the human impact. And, you know, we have a responsibility in Congress to do everything we can to reduce the likelihood that families will experience that kind of loss. You know, a lot of the opponents to responsible gun safety legislation like to argue, oh, there's nothing you can do to stop, you know, you can never eliminate all gun violence, you can never stop all the bad guys. Of course that's true, that you can never eliminate it all. But if you take the sum total of the bills that are introduced that are all designed to reduce gun violence, to make it less likely that criminals and people with serious mental illness will get their hands on really dangerous weapons and cause harm, it will have an impact. It will seriously reduce the number of families who have to experience that kind of pain. And so just because you can't eliminate every single instance of gun violence doesn't mean you shouldn't work really hard to eliminate as much of it as you can. And what has been very frustrating in Congress is the unwillingness of my colleagues on the other side of the aisle to be partners in just common sense proposals. And the sit-in that we organized, Catherine Clark, John Larson, John Lewis, and I, we really did it because we were just incredibly frustrated. After Orlando, we did another moment of silence, and we were trying to force a vote on two bills, universal background checks and a piece of legislation that says if you're on the terror watch list, determined to be too dangerous to get on an airplane, you shouldn't be able to go into a store and buy a gun. These are basic kind of common sense proposals, and despite our efforts, we still have not gotten a vote on either of those bills. And, you know, continue to be very frustrated by it. You know, we keep asking, just give us a vote. If you don't think they're good ideas, vote against them. Or if you have better ideas to reduce gun violence, share them with us. But we simply cannot just do nothing. And I think, you know, the American people are demanding some action. I think my proposal is a very common sense one that's very responsive to a particular problem. But there's a lot more that we need to do to reduce gun violence in this country.
Thank you.
Congressman, I appreciate everything you're saying so very much. And I'm not lost on the irony that your name is David and you're going up against essentially the Goliath of the NRA. What is the vision of the Democratic Party? We're coming up to the midterms next year on gun violence. There's so many of us out here who are absolutely numbed that I'm a parent, and when Sandy Hook happened, that killed me. That killed me to see that violence against children. And when Pulse happened, I'm a gay man, that killed me again. And to your point, Congress has done nothing. No offense to you who is doing something, but nothing has happened. And it seems like it is a prime opportunity for the vision of the Democratic Party to embrace that for those of us who I want to think are a majority of the Americans that would get behind the Democratic Party. Are you hearing that unity in the Democratic Party to come up against this?
Yeah. I mean, I think the answer to that is very simple. We will never make any progress on enacting serious gun safety legislation until we take back the majority. I mean, the Republicans have made it very clear. I've been in Congress for 8 years, will be 8 years at the end of this term, and the Republican House leadership has refused to bring a single bill to the floor. There are well over 100 proposals pending in the Congress of the United States that will in some way respond to the issue of gun violence in this country. The Republican House leadership has refused to bring a single bill to the floor. So on this issue, it's very simple. I mean, there's a strong difference. If you look at the sponsorship and the leadership that's been provided by Democrats, the bills that have been introduced are introduced by Democrats by and large with broad support from the Democratic caucus. So I think it's very simple. We need to take the House back, and I think when we take the House back in 2018, the American people will finally see a Congress prepared to respond in a serious way to the issue of gun violence. We all recognize that the Second Amendment exists and people have a right to have firearms, but that does not mean that we can't do a much better job in keeping guns out of the hands of criminals, people who have serious mental illness such they might cause harm to themselves or others, and that we can't eliminate really dangerous devices like bump stocks that turn guns essentially into machine guns. So there's a lot of work to do. I think the record of the Democrats on this is really clear. And frankly, the only way we're going to make real progress on this, you know, in a serious way, is to take back the responsibilities of leadership from the Republicans in the House and move forward on the Democratic agenda.
Well, Congressman, I totally on behalf agree, of myself... Yeah, go ahead, Rob. I agree.
Yeah, no, I just want
to
say...
On behalf of myself, it's just like, wow. Yeah.
I just want to say also, you know, I am with you, Congressman. I'm going to fight for you guys to take back the House in the midterms, do everything in my power. I hope that is the theme of the Democratic Party in terms of giving the American people the vision of what will happen when you do regain power. You're very needed. We believe in what you're doing, and I really want to thank you for joining us tonight and sharing your vision with us.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on.
Congressman,
thank you.
Sir.
Good night.
Good night,
good night.
Sir.
Well, that was great. And without further ado, waiting patiently in the wings, Aaron Overman, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you for coming on. So you heard the discussion with the congressman. Tell us about gays against guns, which obviously I'm not a member, but I probably should be. So tell us about that organization.
Great, sure. Gays Against Guns was founded in New York just a couple days after the Pulse shootings. That incident happened during Pride Month. It happened in Orlando, you know, right during their Pride as well. And New York Pride was happening during the New York Pride was happening. Just after the Pulse shooting, and the folks in New York really jumped into action and formed a group called Gays Against Guns, and they marched at the front of the New York Pride Parade right after Pulse. They did this sort of sequence of people that they had 49 people dressed all in white that each one of them was representing a victim of the Pulse shootings, and then behind those victims, they had 100, you know, maybe more than 100 people marching, screaming, you know, anti-NRA stuff, people that were just fed up with the scourge of gun violence in America. And so I'm in Washington. We started our group independently, but we're affiliated with the mission of GAG in New York, and we certainly use them as kind of an inspiration for the work that we do. We do very similar things, but we operate on our own.
That's fantastic. Aaron, I want to ask you a question about that. Just an observation a friend of mine had on the LGBT community, where he was frustrated when After Pulse happened and there was a huge outpouring, rightly so, over that tragedy. But for him, it was a little bit bittersweet, and not bittersweet, but bitter, tragic almost, in that he noticed that a lot of the gay people he knew didn't seem to wake up to gun violence until Pulse happened, until it happened to, quote-unquote, us. And his recent comment to me around Las Vegas was, you know, I'm really heartened with the people who were awoken by Pulse are still awake, that when Vegas happened, they were equally as enraged. Do you see Pulse as maybe a wake-up call to us to get involved in something that is outside of what would normally be seen as not necessarily an LGBT-specific issue?
Yeah. I mean, speaking for myself personally, this is the issue that I got involved after Pulse, because I just threw my hands up and said, if I don't get involved in this mission and in this movement, how can I expect other people to carry the water, to fight on behalf of people who are sick of this, that really want things to change and realize that we need to have change in this country about guns. So that's what sort of it took such a horrible incident for me to get involved, but obviously I'm not alone. There's a whole other, you know, lots of other groups that are getting involved. Pride Fund to End the Gun Violence also started right around that same time, and they sort of operate more in the political space. We operate more in kind of the direct action space. But there's a whole bunch of us, and I think the big difference between Pulse and Vegas for a lot of gays is there was just this incredible sense of loss of it, because it was an attack directly against our community. So in the same time that we're trying to get active, we're also dealing with just this intense grief and sense of loss and a lot of sadness. And I don't feel the same sadness anymore. Las Vegas was almost like we were almost expecting that something else was going to happen, and it's going to keep happening. So the groups that are working and doing actions in the streets, raising money, we're in it, and I guess we're already running versus feeling like we took a big hit. I don't feel the Las Vegas incident in the same sort of personal way as an attack against the LGBT community. It's an attack against all of us, and we're all pulling in the same direction now, and we're not wasting any time with this whole grief stuff. I'm over grief.
Karen,
well,
did you have a question for Aaron?
Yeah, Karen, you go ahead, Karen.
Yeah, I do have a question. I seem to not only not be over grief, but I have PTSD from, still grieving over friends I lost to AIDS. So, I think that's something that we actually have to, consider, the fact that there are some people, we were talking earlier about being numb to all this violence, and for some of us, we've just had enough grief, as you say. So we turn away from what we might want to do. Our instinct says, I need to get involved, but, oh my God, it's too painful. I want to ask you, so I appreciate the note about that, but I want to ask you something else that kind of has been scratching up my brain a little bit. There are a number of women, in particular, women who have been the victims of domestic violence, victims of rape, victims of all sorts of harassment, who say, I want a gun to protect myself. I have a right to protect myself. And they don't see that, you know, maybe that gun could be turned around and used on them. And somehow the whole notion of gun violence is different for people who think like that. What do you think about that? Do you have any sort of idea about, I mean, gay people are victims of, you know, LGBT people, hell, trans, African-American, transgender, women of color, you know, are victimized, murdered. If anybody has a right to have a gun and defend themselves, I would imagine it would be them. How do you address that, sort of that psychological component of this?
Sure. I think that's a natural human tendency is to want to protect yourself. And I think a lot of there's certainly kind of an urban-rural thing going on with guns. I think a lot of us who live in cities don't see guns in the same way as rural people do. We see that there are so many communities that are so close to our own homes that gun violence is hitting every day. And so I think we see these kind of like the daily grind of gun violence in a little bit different way in the cities versus rural areas. And there's, I guess there's a, you can look at the statistics of the matter that a gun that you buy is going to be more likely to be shot accidentally and hit somebody innocent, or a child's going to pick it up, or it's going to be shoot a friend or a family member or a loved one in a, you know, an argument. Those are much, much more likely to happen than actually shooting an intruder or somebody who's coming after you. And that's, I think, one of the challenges of the gun prevention violence movement is that you're sort of feeling of wanting to protect yourself and having an object that can make you feel more powerful doesn't line up to the statistics and the reality of what guns actually do. And the it's very rare that a law-abiding gun owner is actually taking down a criminal. It doesn't happen. If it was happening all the time, I think the NRA and all these groups would be talking about it all the time. The reason they don't talk about it is because it doesn't happen. So it's a natural tendency, and I can understand why people would want to protect themselves, but it's just it's not the case that it actually provides any sort of protection for people.
I think you're raising really important points, Aaron, because I've heard the arguments, and you know, and I want to be sympathetic to somebody who, like Karen pointed out, may have been in something horrific, and it is kind of the security to feel like they can protect themselves. And quite frankly, you know, if they're doing it with a handgun where, you know, if it's there's going to be an accident, well, I can't even speak to the safety because, as you pointed out, there are statistics that show that it isn't necessarily a good thing. I can tell you anecdotally, though, or share with the panel that I come from a long line of Republicans. I am the black sheep of the family, thank you. And my sister's family, who I can guarantee you won't be listening to this show anyway, have a gun arsenal. And none of them are trained. They're, you know, Orange County Republicans. They're locked in their garage. It's in this big safe thing. And I cannot, for the life of me, understand what the practical use of that is. It apart from the fact that they want to exercise what they see as their privilege to own these horrific weapons, and they're not trained on them. And short of the Russians landing on their lawn and giving them 20 minutes notice that they're approaching their front door, there's no use that could be possibly positive. And quite frankly, there are members of the family who have been in treatment for bipolar disorder and things like that, and I don't know that something could snap. I mean, it is actually a scary situation. That's my personal family. And you multiply that out across the country, I think therein lies the problem. My two cents.
Let me, Aaron, let me ask you this. As I'm sure as an activist, you may or may not be aware of what we call the Dickey Amendment. The Dickey Amendment or the legislation was enacted in 1996. And what it did specifically was that it blocked the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta from doing gun control advocacy, for example, such as accepting for publication articles that were obviously biased or rejecting articles that found any positive benefits to gun ownership. Now, that was in a letter written by Dr. Timothy Wheeler, who was the founder and the past director of Doctors for Responsible Gun Ownership, and testimony before Congress, which was in favor of the measure. Now, over the last few years, and particularly in the last 8 years, that we've seen repeated acts of mass violence perpetrated by gun violence, there has been calls again to have the CDC intervene, principally, as one person argued as recently as 3 days ago, that the Centers for Disease Control are talking about a pandemic. This is more than just an action of people in gun ownership. This is wanton acts of violence. As an activist and as someone who's concerned with this issue, would you be supportive in lobbying members of Congress to let the CDC start pushing forward with resuming gun violence research, which they were doing previous to the passage of the Dickey Amendment nearly 24 years ago?
Right, right. One pivot that we've seen the am I still on? I just heard a sound.
You are still on. I heard the sound too.
Okay.
I don't know what that is.
All right.
I have no idea.
Great.
It sounded like the old disconnect sound. Go ahead, sir.
It did. It was like an old-timey phone sound. So the gun violence in the United States is a public health crisis, and I don't think that there's any other way to describe it. And it's not just the deaths. It's the injuries and the permanent disabling injuries that we have to deal with and pay for as a society. You look at the cost of it, and it's in the hundreds of billions of dollars a year to not just in, like, you know, lost wages of people who died, you know, basic sort of mathematical addition like that, but you know, the health costs of taking care of people who remain injured, and the families that they can't take care of anymore. So it is a public health crisis. And when you mentioned the CDC, a lot of the folks that founded Gays Against Guns were involved in the ACT UP movement back in the 90s with the AIDS crisis. And the CDC was a major target of ACT UP because they were ignoring what was the public health crisis of that time, AIDS and HIV and the you know, thousands of people who were dying from that. They were just being ignored. So in some ways, it's similar. They're both public health crisis, and they're not getting the funding and the attention and the research and all the things they need to try and stem the tide of death that's going on in both cases. So I think there's a thread that runs through both of those things, the AIDS crisis and the public health crisis of gun violence in America. And it's hard to figure out where you can have an effect if you're not studying the problem. And when you're banning people from even talking about the problem or researching the problem, absolutely, mm-hmm. We need to do more at that. I think that's an easy thing to advocate for, but it's a hard thing to do when it's you know, it's easier to close your eyes to the problem. And certainly, the NRA and the Republican Party want us to keep our eyes closed to the problem.
Well, quick pause. Then let me have a quick follow-up then with that, if you don't mind, Aaron. And you just brought that to the forefront. In listening to the congressman, do you feel more comfortable and confident in the policies of the Democratic Party in being able to achieve some limited measure of success in this particular issue? Or do you, as an activist and as a person looking at this issue overall see yourself as banging your head against the wall?
Well, I think there's a – you certainly can't say that it's totally a Republican problem. When Democrats were in charge of Congress, we didn't see any movement or in the space either. So it's you know, blame on all sides, but it's also not it is also a fact that the NRA, the National Rifle Association, is an arm of the Republican Party. You look at how much money they take in, and you look at how they spend their money. It's all toward the Republican side or against Democrats. They're trying to elect Republicans or get people to not vote Democrats. So I when you look at where the money is, that's certainly a one-sided issue. And I think as we've seen a lot of the on the Democratic side, the politicians that used to sort of walk the NRA side, but, you know, talk a different way. Just as things have changed over time, I think there are fewer and fewer Democrats who sort of tolerate the NRA and go after that kind of rating to have a high rating from them. There are fewer and fewer of them. So I think a lot of the solutions do lie with, just as the congressman said earlier, with different leadership in Congress and different control of Congress. There can possibly be some changes made, but if a bunch of kids being shot in an elementary school don't get the Republicans to change, and a nightclub full of people are killed, and then a whole concert full of people are shot up, and they do nothing, how can we expect that they're going to change? They won't change. And I think it's incumbent upon us to not think that they're going to. We have to focus our efforts on having them not have their jobs anymore, not hoping that they're going to come around on the issue.
Okay, I'll hand you off to Karen Oakham.
Hi there. I have a question. you know, you mentioned ACT UP, and out here in California, as you're probably well aware, Los Angeles in particular, West Hollywood, we had a group called Queer Nation did all sorts of creative demonstrations and protests. And I'm wondering if you guys have thought about sort of being creative in your demonstrations, kind of like a cross between Queer Nation and Code Pink, and going to these hearings and demonstrating at these hearings. I mean, we were talking earlier about you know, the mental health issues. Well, heavens, that was like one of the first bills that, and maybe the only bill, that Trump signed was revoking the gun checks for people who were mentally ill. So, I mean, I'm wondering if you guys have any sort of long-term strategic planning in addition to having this activism fervor. I mean, knowing that there are hearings on the Hill, targeting specific congressional members, being creative in how you do it, you know, things like that. I mean, is there any strategic planning other than just an emotional response when something dire happens like this?
Sure. That's such a good question. I did mention the human beings, the people who dress all in white and represent a single victim. That's a really powerful thing, and they're always silent when they're in that role. So it's a really powerful thing to see somebody dressed all in white in a veil and carrying a picture and name of a victim of gun violence. And one of the things that GAG New York has done over the summer is they've actually brought human beings to gun shows in Pennsylvania. And I'm just amazed at the courage that something like that takes to walk into the parking lot of a gun show where people are buying and selling guns, and to stand there with the name of a victim. And they also, you know, there's also people that go in not the full dress and do speak and might hand out literature, but it's just meant to sort of bring that energy of the victims into these spaces that they're not welcome. People don't want us to think about that. And
well, then why do that in the gallery of Congress? I mean, you know, regular citizens are allowed to go into the second floor in the gallery and watch the House and this, you know, watch the House make law. If you know that something's coming up, or even in advance of something coming up, just a startling thing, go in dressed as an ordinary citizen and then quietly change in the gallery and then stand there all in white, all a lot of you, with portraits of dead people hanging from your necks. I mean, you know, we need to do something to shake people up. And it's going to the gun shows are fine, but they'll just look at you as leftist kooks. They'll worry about you, as a matter of fact, attacking them. So, right now the attention is paid on Congress, and since you are based in D.C., I'm wondering if you've thought about those kind of creative tactics.
Sure. And I guess one thing that, in regard to the gun shows and other things, is so much of this battle is taking place online and in social media now. So the in-person thing is one thing, but you can amplify and spread your message by you know, filming it and putting it on social media. One of the things we've talked about doing for Gag DC is very similar to what you're talking about, but making it more personal. Going to congressional offices with a story of a victim and bringing that human being of the victim and reading the story in the congressional office space of where the person was living, their representative, and then bringing that message to the district where the people live. So we almost can become the local activists or you know, if they're in Colorado or something like that, it's pretty hard for a person from Colorado to come to D.C. to do this activism. But we could bring the spirit of that person into a congressional office of a congressman from Colorado and film it and bring those stories back to those districts via social media. So I think that's one of the things that we've talked about doing and that we want to make more of a program. It's not about being reactive. I think when shootings happen and these mass shootings happen, and the reaction is you know, it feels like it's tamped down every time, even though the numbers of people who die increase every time. But if we can keep up a kind of a drumbeat of, we're going to keep at this issue, we're going to keep bringing these stories to Congress and filming them, and also kind of leading up toward next year's midterm elections, I think there's a lot of stuff that we could do in that space in Washington, kind of like you're describing. Maybe not kind of in a hearing room or something like that, but bringing that story to an office and to a Congress member.
Yeah, Aaron, I wanted to follow up on what you just said, because that was part of the question that I was asking the congressman. And I think there was a subtle difference between what his answer was and where I was going. In the midterms, and you brought this up just a few minutes ago when you were talking about it, it's not just a Republican problem, it's the Democrats as well. Do you feel like the Democrats are setting themselves up well enough to walk out in the campaign of the midterms to say, this is our vision, we are the party that will get us through gun violence? Is that voice coming through, in your opinion?
Are you asking me that?
No, I was asking Aaron that.
Oh, okay.
So I guess one of the things that I'm frustrated with is, and even our group, we have in our mission statement things like background checks at gun shows, gun sales via the internet and banning them, you know, loopholes loopholes that exist. If we're going to really start to tackle this problem in a real way, every life that you can save is a life saved, and it's worth it. But, you know, bringing it from 35,000 deaths a year to 30,000, that's still 30,000 deaths. How do we get it down to a low number, a very low number? I don't think that
sniffing
around the edges is going to get you down to a low number. So, you know, it's sort of like, what can you accomplish now, and what can you describe now? But if you're not presenting a vision that brings you down to, your goal should be zero. The goal should be zero,
right.
and banning gun sales via the internet and background checks is not going to get you to zero. So I think that's sort of what's lacking on all these kind of political fronts now is a vision for the future that leads you toward zero gun deaths. I don't see that.
I hear you, and I've got a question actually for you and the panel, and Brody's got a follow-up question after that. But this is my question to all three of you guys. The congressman made one comment before he left, and it kind of sat weird with me because I'm seeing something that has gotten normalized that I think should be up for debate, and that is the true meaning of the Second Amendment, in that it has traditionally meant states have the right to form militias. That's what the Second Amendment says. That's what it has, where the legal system for legacy has understood it to be. And it has turned into this populist, I have the right to pack heat type of thing. And to Aaron, to your point, it's like, in my opinion, if that's not challenged, we don't have an easy path to get down to those zero deaths. Because, you know, it's we can minimize, we can get certain guns off the market, but end of day, those guns are more lethal than any other killing device. I mean, the Boston bombers, who planned for months and strategized to plant their bomb, killed like four people. You know, the gun people kill dozens and dozens. And they're killing more because the weapons are getting even better or worse, depending on how you think about it. So my question is, are we having the right conversation around the Second Amendment? And I open that up to all three of you.
Well, my follow-up question was actually to Aaron, because the sacred cow in the room is, of course, the Second Amendment. And you're absolutely right. But we had a change in the 1970s and 80s with the rise of the modern conservative movement, particularly during the Reagan administration under Edwin Meese as Attorney General, and at the same time, Orrin Hatch of Utah, the sustaining argument being that the courts had misunderstood the Second Amendment. And at that point, really about 1977, the NRA went from being, for the most part, a very apolitical gun safety organization into an extremely highly mechanized political action committee, if you will. And one of the things that happens is that under that, we had a couple of rulings. The one that probably reversed the precedents the most, of course, was the District of Columbia versus Heller in 2008. And that was the case, with tremendous influence from Justice Scalia and Thomas, that it reversed these decades of precedents. And the Heller case gave individuals, and I'm putting that in parents, gave individuals a right to bear arms. However, the problem with Heller in the way it was written was that it didn't actually go and say how extensive that right is. Now, obviously, when you have people like Senator Dianne Feinstein of California, who has experienced horrible violence, gun violence firsthand, with the assassination of Mayor Moscone and Supervisor Milken in 78, and through her entire career, not only as mayor of San Francisco, but as senator from California, you know, she's pointed out that there needs to be limitations on this. So let's talk about the elephant in the room. And this is better conversation with Rob, Karen, and you, Aaron, because as a Canadian, I don't have a dog in the hunt, as you Americans say. But my viewpoint as a Canadian looking at it is that the Second Amendment is an archaic piece of written law that probably would be better repealed and then replaced with something that was a little bit more common sense. So I'm going to throw that out to you three.
Karen,
well,
Aaron, do you have a view? Go, Karen.
I do. Well, I think that, you know, as Brody alluded to, you know, previously the NRA was kind of a gun control club. You know, where, I mean, not a gun control, it was a gun club that understood, you know, as the congressman was saying, common sense regulations. And then what you had happen is in 1991, you have Wayne LaPierre take it over. Now, remember, this is the hotbed of the debate around Bill Clinton. You know, it was Reagan Bush versus, you know, and Bush sort of represented Reagan still. But, I mean, Bill Clinton came on the scene. And so it was all these, it was a popularity contest. Remember, Wayne LaPierre had Charlton Heston holding that musket up at the NRA convention saying, "You'll have to pry this out of my cold, dead hands." I mean, the thing was, it was like, do you want to be like, you know, Ben-Hur and Davy Crockett and, you know, the Musketeers and the Alamo? Do you want to be that brave, popular, macho man? Or do you want to be the wimpy, you know, Bill Clinton feminist type? So it turned into a different kind of a cultural war battle that really had nothing to do with regulations. But then it became so etched in stone in this popular, you know, as Obama said, be careful about talking to people about gays, guns, and God. I mean, guns are right in there. Guns are at the center of this cultural war, as are gays and women and everything about God and their interpretation of God. So that, for me, is when it turned in sort of this cultural war sentiment where people became sentimental and then hardened about their sentiment, about their precious guns, as if they were talking about, you know, something else, you know, below
right.
the belt.
Right. Okay. We went there. Okay, good. Aaron, what
well,
what
I
your
went
thoughts?
There without saying, so, you know. But that's what guns
yeah,
are.
I love it.
That is the image, that is the metaphor for me. That's why these guys like their guns so much, and especially this rat-a-tat-tat thing. This is a little more than a pissing contest, if you know what I mean. It's the next stage of the pissing contest. So, you know, guys and their guns.
Right.
Sorry.
Yeah,
I
just wonder with.
Go ahead, Aaron. Go ahead.
Oh, sure. What Karen is saying about the culture wars issue, you look at their videos and their propaganda that they put out now, and they did a video the week before the Las Vegas shooting about standing for the Pledge of Allegiance. I mean, what does that have to do with guns? That has nothing to do with guns. But they're fully in this whole extreme right culture war space at this point. And I guess the question I have is the more that they go further and further, harder right, and the people that kind of did recognize the NRA as a gun club and something that was, you know, not crazy, they're showing they're crazy really more and more as the weeks and months go on here. So how I think that was one of the things about the Women's March getting involved in the NRA protesting the NRA too, is that, you know, normal people, regular people are waking up to the fact that they're a right-wing crazy culture war group. They're not a normal a rational actor at this point.
Well, let me ask you this, because we've only got about 5 minutes left, and I know Rob's got two more questions, but I have a follow-up to what you just said. Let's talk about Gays Against Guns. Let's talk about effectiveness, and to Karen's point earlier, what is it that you can do? What is it that you can tell our listeners? What's the most important thing, in your estimation, as a member of Gays Against Guns, that needs to be taken in terms of action? What do we need for action, Aaron?
Sure. I think in terms of action is people need to talk about this issue all the time and don't give up. The NRA and groups affiliated with them want to scare us, and they want to get us to give up this issue, to think that things will never change, to think that they're so powerful and we will never, ever get any sort of headway on gun safety or anything. We're just going to be awashing guns forever. It's not true, and people need to stand up for that and talk to their friends about it and talk to their families about it. Join groups like GAG. There's a lot of gun violence prevention groups that aren't queer-focused, like Brady Campaign and Moms Demand Action, and there's a whole bunch of different groups out there. So join a group. Go to their meetings, write letters to your elected officials. There's a whole group of gun violence prevention activists that are out there waiting for more voices to join them and more bodies to join them. So find a group that you like and join it and participate.
Aaron, I wanted to kind of follow up on that. Is GAG national, or are you more Washington, D.C.? And of the different groups that you mentioned, are they networked? Is when you join a group, are you connected with the activities and visions of across the country? Because to Karen's point, a campaign of activism, the way she described the people showing up in state houses and a similar kind of protest the way ACT UP did, could be really effective, especially if it's repeated and repeated and possible. Or is that network not in place?
So I guess I can only speak from my personal experience. The GAG is most powerful in New York. Their numbers are really strong in New York. They have hundreds of people that show up at their events, and they're big there. We're smaller. We're scrappy, but we're smaller here in Washington. And I know that there's groups that are trying to start around the country. But there's a group called Pride Fund to End Gun Violence that is more of a kind of nationwide focus and looking at races, political races nationwide and fundraising. So that's a group that really anyone from around the country could get involved in phone banking, donating. If they endorse a race, it doesn't have to be – it could be a local race anywhere. And the question about the networking – we have people from Brady who show up to our meetings. We go to other people's protests. We work with Brady Campaign a lot. I think it's really organic, and the gun violence prevention movement is really kind of cool in that way, that there's kind of affinities, but we all realize that we're strong when we pull in the same direction, and we do work together and kind of show up at each other's events and support each other.
Well, Aaron, thank you so much for coming on. We really appreciate your voice and your activism. We've got literally 60 seconds left. I do want to point out to people to listen to us again next week here on Rated LGBT Radio, also out in Santa Cruz on www.ksco.com live stream. This week we will be doing gay ghost hunting. We will actually be going out searching for gay ghosts. A different take on things. Last 30 seconds, Aaron, take us home. What is your final message on this to our listeners?
All right. I think that if you're waking up at this point and realizing that you've had enough and you want things to change, you've got to get your body and your voice in the game, and you can't sit back and let other people take this issue on. You've got to do something yourself. Donate your money, donate your time, join a group, do something, get involved. It's vital that you join up and work together. Otherwise, you can't think that things will change. They won't.
Perfect. Our lives depend upon it. Thank you, Aaron, for joining us. Thank you to Brody and Karen. As always, you're brilliant. And thank you to Congressman Chitiling. Really appreciated his work and participation. You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio. Listen next week. We'll be here.